Hi, everyone. You're listening to Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition, where we bring you the latest trends in the oncology pharmacy space. I'm your host, Alex Gerlach, and today I'm joined by Caitlin Rausch, PharmD, BCOP, from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Today, we're going to talk about revumenib, from dosing, drug interaction management, patient counseling, and food, fungals, and flexibility. We'll also talk about how pharmacists are approaching treatment for KMT2A rearranged and NPM1 mutated acute leukemias. It's a bit of a mouthful, but a big topic deserves one. Thanks so much for joining me today, Caitlin. Why don't you kick us off with an introduction for our audience?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. My name is Caitlin Rausch. I'm a pharmacist in leukemia. I am a graduate of University of Michigan, where I went to undergrad and pharmacy school and did all my residency training there as well. Then moved down to Houston, where I worked on the leukemia service as a clinical pharmacist for 8 years. And now I've moved into doing more of kind of research focus with the leukemia department itself. So treated a lot of patients that were part of the AUGMENT trial, as well as other trials with revumenib. So do have some hands-on experience kind of in the clinical trial setting and a little bit in the since it's gone commercial. But certainly this is a great topic in my interest area of leukemia, as well as drug interactions, antifungals, et cetera.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for that. So let's just kind of jump in before we go into, you know, kind of dosing flexibility. Let's just talk about revumenib in and of itself, you know, what kind of drug it is, you know, maybe what some of the data from the AUGMENT 101 trial looks like.
Yeah, sure. So revumenib is one of the menin inhibitors. So it is an oral targeted drug in that it works specifically for patients that have KMT2A rearranged leukemia, or it also works for patients who have NPM1 mutated leukemia, amongst others that are kind of under investigation that impact this menin pathway. So in the way that the menin inhibitors work is that they allow for essentially the cell that's stuck kind of in its developmental process to continue on and differentiate and then be killed later on. And that is important in terms of knowing how it works because that is associated with one of the side effects of the medication, differentiation syndrome, because of, like I said, the way in which it leads to cellular death. So it is a targeted medication and that it's only going to be working in specific subgroups of patients who have certain mutations. And it's exciting because patients with KMT2A rearranged leukemia were traditionally a very high-risk subgroup, particularly when they relapse. So these patients don't tend to have a lot of effective therapies beyond intensive chemotherapy in the relapse setting. So it's very exciting that we have revumenib as an option for these patients. And in the AUGMENT trial, we saw that revumenib was effective in that it led to responses or complete remissions in these patients who were relapsed simply on its own, which is very exciting, and that it does have a toxicity profile that is relatively manageable. So QTC prolongation, differentiation syndrome, but these are some toxicities that we know that we are aware of and that other drugs cause them with some nuances. But that to say, it's very exciting when we have a new drug that has activity on its own, because not only can we give it by itself, but clinical trials and research continue giving it in combination or looking at ways to improve its efficacy even further.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that introduction into revumenib. So we're going to move into dosing flexibility in this patient population. So why PK pharmacokinetics and dosing flexibility data matter specifically, not as a regulatory checkbox, but as a practical treatment delivery issue. So now that this agent has entered practice for a population heavily defined by polypharmacy, disease severity, and variable clinical status, what made dosing flexibility a priority question to answer for this drug specifically?
Yeah, I think any medication entering the space in patients who have relapsed disease, especially, it's really important for us to be able to understand the best way to administer this medication. And for flexibility, it's very important because often these patients have a number of medications that they're taking. So there are certain medications, of course, that need to be given at a certain time of day or cannot be administered with another type of medication. And so, being able to, for patients to be able to take multiple medications at the same time, for example, helps with, their adherence to all of their medications. And also for them to have as few restrictions as possible, so that way they do find that it is feasible for them to take the medications and stay on the medications, which can be a barrier. We, having oral medications is very exciting for us in the oncology space, especially in leukemia. But at the same time, we have to remember that with oral medications, we rely on our patients to be able to take the medication at the right time in the right way, every day or twice a day, whatever it may be. And so, kind of reducing as many barriers as we can to adherence, is helpful at all costs, for sure.
Thank you so much. So, we're going to talk a little bit more about the AUGMENT-101 trial. So, the analysis drew pharmacokinetic data from 335 patients across a wide age range. Why characterize dosing flexibility using the full AUGMENT-101 population rather than a smaller, dedicated substudy?
It's actually pretty exciting that we have a large population to that the PK information was gathered from, because very often, like you mentioned, we do have these like small sub studies, which is really limiting because we only have then evidence from 10 or 12 patients, rather than 200, nearly or 300 patients total, if including adults and pediatrics for the revumenib. So it's nice because it actually gives you a solid data set, and you have patients that are receiving concomitant medications like antifungals or antacids and things like that. So you can actually glean a lot more information, and you can just have a lot more meaningful data set, because it's more of like a real world data set than a small study of just a few patients where you're unsure. Having results of just one or two people may skew your PK results, and that is really impactful since we're then going to be taking that data and applying it for all of our patients going forward.
Great. Thank you so much. So we're going to move into the next chapter section of this episode, talking about food effect and gastric pH, what changes, what doesn't. For a drug that's this soluble across the pH range, whether a patient just ate or is on a PPI simply isn't a variable clinicians need to worry about. But also let's go into, what it looks like, in terms of a low fat meal. So it seems like that reduce a low fat meal reduced revumenib Cmax by 27% and AUC by 12%. Why doesn't that translate into a recommendation to take revumenib on an empty stomach?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so again, luckily, with having such a large data set like we do have, we're able to kind of make recommendations with a little more confidence, I guess you could say. So the Cmax was reduced by nearly a third on average, compared to patients that had taken the medication on an empty stomach. But the reason why it did not translate into a dose reduction recommendation is because the range in which was observed for the Cmax in the fed patients. So the average was 27% lower compared to the average of the patients who had an empty stomach, but the ranges that were observed for the Cmax in both groups overlapped. So because of that, we didn't see that there was such a significant reduction, as well as the AUC, which is essentially like the exposure, the total exposure of the drug, that was reduced by just 12%. So a pretty small amount. And again, when comparing or when calculating that AUC between the fed patients, those that had the low fat meal versus those that had an empty stomach, there was a lot of crossover. Really, if we were to take that information and then tell patients to take a different dose, we would not be confident that they were actually getting the exposure that they needed. And so, because, like I said, there's such a large amount of crossover between those that had an empty stomach and those that had eaten the low fat meal, there was not enough of a difference to make a recommendation and a dose change, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you so much for that insight. So let's move into talking about, so not low fat meal, not specifically related to someone's diet in food intake, but patients who are also taking antacids, H2 blockers, or PPIs. So roughly half saw no alterations of revumenib or M1 exposure. What explains that, given how sensitive some oral oncolytics are to gastric pH?
So every medication will be subject to changes in gastric pH to a different degree depending on that solubility. And for any pharmacists out there, this brings me back to like pharmacy school, learning about the different types of medications in terms of their solubility, their class. Because revumenib is highly soluble, regardless of the range, or at least this, even in an acidic pH and higher, we did not there was no difference that was seen in any of these PK values that were analyzed, so Cmax, AUC, or half-life. And just because this medication is okay with different pH ranges doesn't mean other medications are. So, each medication is different in terms of how it's metabolized and absorbed and whatnot. So, it's important that we understand every medication individually and how it interacts with other medications. And the reason, again, is just because revumenib happens to have a high solubility regardless of the pH, which is great because so many of our patients are taking some sort of antacid or H2 blocker or something. So this is definitely a very real world scenario where we see the need for people to be on an acid blocking medication.
Great. So beyond our acid blocking medications, and diet, we also have a CYP3A4 interactions. These do carry some pretty significant clinical weight. So co-administration with strong CYP3A4 inhibitors seems to double revumenib Cmax and AUC. Given how common antifungal prophylaxis is in this population, how should that finding change practice?
This is a honestly great thing that they did with this clinical trial. So often do we have a new drug that is approved in this patient population, and we have to kind of further dig or understand what the interactions will be with antifungal medications. And so it was nice that they had, patients actually on the trial intentionally on the azole medications that are so often used. So that was wonderful. And because of that, though, we do see that there is a significant dose difference for patients that are receiving strong CYP3A4 inhibitors versus those that are not receiving strong CYP3A4 inhibitors. It may change your practice in that you may more often want to keep your patients on the strong CYP3A4 inhibitor because we have the good dosing data, or if you're changing from one azole antifungal to another, you may want to stick with the strong CYP3A4 inhibitors, or if you have to change to another antifungal that is a moderate inhibitor and you're changing from one to another, you know that you need to change the dosing of the revumenib. So I think in that it changes practice in just that understanding that it what you're choosing for your antifungal will impact your revumenib dosing.
Awesome. So that actually kind of moves us into moderate CYP3 A4 inhibitors. So talking about like fluconazole, seems like there was no meaningful effect, and M1 exposure was unaffected regardless of inhibitor potency. Why does this distinction matter for a clinician deciding whether a dose adjustment is warranted?
So the metabolite, the M1 metabolite, it does impact your safety a bit in that the metabolite kind of impacts the QTC interval. So that's relevant, but the M1 actually doesn't have a lot of activity in terms of the action of the drug or efficacy of the drug otherwise. Both the parent drug and the metabolite had a significant exposure with the strong, or I'm sorry, just the parent drug really had significant change in exposure with strong inhibitors. So, I guess something to be aware of is that is really that QTC monitoring, which we will be doing anyway, because there is kind of some differences in the M1 metabolite exposure. But again, I think the true like take home point here is just understanding that your moderate inhibitors, fluconazole and isavuconazole, did not lead to a significant change in revumenib exposure, whereas the strong inhibitors did. And like I said, it was in the parent drug more so than the like metabolite, but again, the metabolite does not play a meaningful role in the efficacy of the medication. So making sure you understand what degree or potency of inhibition your azole antifungal and other medications are, is what needs to be done for sure.
Great. So for a pharmacist reviewing a new revumenib patient's medication list, what should actually be flagged based on the data that we just discussed?
So any azole antifungal, and really any CYP3A4 inhibitor, moderate or strong. And I say that they do need to flag the moderate inhibitors as well, just to make sure, that the revumenib is dosed correctly. So if a patient is on, isavuconazole, they should be at the full 270 milligram dose of revumenib versus if they're on voriconazole, they should be at just the 160. So making sure that there is a correct match between the antifungal or whatever CYP3A4 inhibitor that they're on, there's a match between the potency of that and the dose of the revumenib.
Great. So let's take all of this and package it up with a nice pretty bow, put it into practice, and talk about patient counseling. So if you were advising a pharmacist managing a patient on revumenib today, what's the one thing from this data set that should change how they counsel on timing, food, or drug interactions?
I think, like I mentioned, I can't harp on this enough, but just the first thing is the drug interactions, in terms of, for the pharmacists themselves, I guess, making sure that the dosing is correct. But when talking to patients, I think the nice thing, the luxury, if you will, is that The medication is dosed twice per day, so you can kind of you can they can take the medication with other medications if they need to, including their PPI or histamine blockers. They can take it with a snack or without, however they choose. So you can use that information to kind of help them figure out what works best for them in terms of the timing of when they're taking their medications, which I think is very impactful. And most, if not all of the patients I've had, they appreciate kind of going through this list of medicines that they're receiving and understanding, okay, when, how can I put this together in a puzzle, and having some flexibility with at least one of them is very helpful. So I think the one other thing, as we're talking with our patients, we've been discussing the CYP3A4 inhibitors ad nauseum, but it's important to let them know that this medication is subject to drug interactions, so that they need to let their leukemia team know if they're being seen by another provider and they're prescribed a new medication. They should always reach out to their leukemia team just to make sure there's no interactions. So anything that they're prescribed that's a prescription or even over-the-counter medications, they should always be in the habit of letting us know so we can kind of always do that drug interaction check. And we should also be counseling them about grapefruit juice, as with all CYP3A4 substrates. So, again, lots of flexibility with how they can take it, but I think just making sure they're aware that it can be subject to drug interactions. So, always keeping in touch with your team, to let you know if there's anything new or that they're changing as well.
Great. Yeah, and we know that when it comes to cancer treatment, patient choice is often a very empowering for people who are facing something that is very life-changing. So the analysis leaned on population pharmacokinetic modeling across the full AUGMENT-101 cohort. What is still open? Additional interactions, pediatric-specific dosing nuances, or are there any other populations that you'd want to see characterized next?
Yeah, I think interactions with other oral chemotherapy medications is always interesting to know. And as you know, as the experience and the research continues using these drugs in combination with other medications, it's would be great if there was always PK data going along with that, which is hard to ask for, but would be amazing to get that every time. And then really other populations too would be, patients with renal impairment or hepatic impairment. That comes up so often in these populations, especially kind of in the context of differentiation syndrome. Patients may have a renal impairment as a result if they have severe if they have severe differentiation syndrome or whatever it may be. These patients have, in the relapse setting, have kind of gone through a number of treatments and things. So, getting more information about patient about that patient population would also be very helpful.
Great. And we pretty much reached the end of this discussion. And thank you so much again for all your great insights. But just kind of a closing thought here, above everything else that we've talked about data-wise, what do you want a treating pharmacist to walk away remembering from this conversation about treating patients with revumenib?
I think just making sure that you're checking for drug interactions and that you're translating those important ones to the patient. Luckily we don't need to harp on or worry about the whole antacid or acid suppression medication, but just being aware of the medication list and that also taking a time for yourself. If you are recommending a change in medication for a patient on revumenib, that it may impact the revumenib dosing. So, not to change their other medications kind of
without a great reason, and making sure that you're understanding the implications to the revumenib dose if there has to be a change, because that is also another step that will need to be done as well.